happens between there and school. Damn, said Rachel, as they walked away stopping at the cafe for cappuccinos and donuts. Unfortunately, that kind of corroborates what Lisa Urquhart said. Shall I get her in for questioning again? The uniform who brought her in said Michelle's dog was still there at Lisa's house. They couldn't find a passport for Michelle in Jubilee Terrace, but she wouldn't necessarily have taken it there from Willow Way. No, Rachel shook her head, but see if you can organise some surveillance on her place. If you can't, let me know and I'll get our operations unit onto it. Maybe there should be another search at Willow Way to locate the passport, if nothing else, okay? Rajava's expression was unreadable, but Rachel could take a fair guess at how she was feeling. Look, Stacy's admission is a huge step. It's evidence tying Michelle Harper to Harry Brown, something that's a bit more than circumstantial. That may be true, only now we've got a missing child and a missing mother. Rachel returned to Tinworth Street and called an emergency briefing with Patton, Gilly Durante, Nick Furnish and Giles Denton. She outlined the new evidence from Ben Weather's statement and Stacey Fisher's admission. Even without the Romanians' alibis standing up, it's looking less and less likely that the two girls are linked. Our priority now is to find Michelle Harper. Surrey Police have set up an ANPR alert for her car, and we've requested a blue notice from Interpol in case she's tried to leave the UK. Well done, D.I. Prince. Patton gave a rare smile. You've really helped the local force with pushing the investigation forward. Giles Denton suggested they all adjourn to the Pin and Needle for a Christmas drink, and she accepted with alacrity, not because of his swarthy Irish looks, but because she was ready to forget about Lola Jade Harper for a few hours. She texted Brickle and demanded that he join them, adding cryptically, Santa's paying a visit. Brickle stared at his cashmere scarf with an opaque expression. I haven't got you anything. He was gruff to cover surprise or pleasure or both. That's okay, you can go and buy me a drink. He grinned, wrapped the scarf twice round his neck and came back with two large glasses of mulled wine. The pub was decked with bushy swags of tinsel and wreaths of fake holly. There was also, Rachel noted, a bunch of mistletoe very prominently placed on the customer side of the bar. See that? Brickle pointed at the mistletoe. I see it. And see that? He pointed to Giles Denton. You're Pierce Brosnan look-alike, just saying. So immature, Brickle. But as the evening wore on, and the number of empty mulled wine glasses on their table grew, Rachel found herself hovering near the mistletoe in the hope that Denton would notice it. Eventually he did. It's a pagan tradition, he told her. What is? Rachel asked innocently. Kissing under the mistletoe. Wouldn't be at all suitable for a good Catholic boy like myself. He winked at her. Just as well I'm a pagan, then. Rachel stared him down, her body language daring him to do it. And he did. He leaned in and kissed her full on the mouth, lingering longer than was strictly necessary, parting his lips slightly. Merry Christmas, Rachel Prince. He gave her an intense look with eyes as dark as the North Sea, then walked away. Fucking hell, Prince, what is it with you and the men round here? Brickle, who had been watching the entire encounter, frowned in mock disapproval. You're law enforcement kryptonite. Chapter 32. I knew we should have remanded the silly cow. It was Monday morning, and Rachel had not even made it out of her flat before her phone rang with a call from Leela Rajavi. Before she had even pressed accept, she already knew what Rajavi was about to say. Yet again the story had been emblazoned in black and white, 2-inch-high capital letters across the front of a Sunday tabloid. This time it was a competitor for the paper that Rachel had locked horns with over the Carly Weathers leak. Lola Jade Mum in Sex Change Boy Mystery. Michelle Harper, mum of missing 7-year-old Lola Jade Harper, has been sighted in the Eastwell area with a mystery boy the same age, a source told us. Stacy must have blabbed, Rachel concurred with a sigh. Well, the papers don't name the source, but I think we can assume it was her. It isn't even accurate. Michelle hasn't been sighted with Harry at all. She's far too canny for that. And Stacy doesn't know anything about what Ben Weathers told us in his statement either, said Rajavi. In fact, if you read the article, it's a bit of a non-event, mainly because Stacy's too dim to really join the dots. She just saw a chance to make a few quid on the sly. And yet again a paper's opened itself up nicely to a charge of contempt of court for prejudicing legal proceedings, Rachel pointed out. Although since Michelle's not been charged with anything yet, that's a moot point. She'd already done a runner before Stacy sold the story. The line went quiet, while Rajavi weighed up what Rachel had said. So are you saying we should hold off on making any public response? Absolutely, said Rachel. It will only make us look like we don't know what we're doing and open the floodgates to the crackpots. Right now we have other fish to fry. She wanted a swim, but today she would need to forego her exercise fix and go straight to the office. Before she had even reached her desk, she picked up a text from Rajavi. Those other fish, one of them has just turned up. Michelle Harper's white BMW was in a private car park in Feltham, Middlesex, parked in a far corner against the wire perimeter fence. At first glance, it was empty and clean of any possessions or the usual detritus that accumulates in a car. When Rachel and Rajavi arrived, a forensics team was standing by while a canine handler set his Springer Spaniel bitch to work. The Spaniel first extensively inhaled from a piece of Lola Jade's clothing, then jumped into the open rear hatchback and started sniffing, so absorbed in her task that her body was vibrating with energy. Then she sat, frozen and staring, with her nose pointing to the carpet on the floor of the boot. One of the suited forensics officers stepped forward and started gathering microscopic samples. "She's indicating," whispered Rajavi. "A cadaver dog?" Rachel wanted to know. Rajavi walked over to speak to the handler. "Not human remains specifically, just human material," she told Rachel when she came back. "We'll know more when we get the forensics back." Rachel pivoted on the spot, staring around the car park. A jumbo jet screamed over their heads on the southeastern flight path. She pointed up at it. "If we're looking for reasons to dump the car here, then there's the obvious one. We must be, what, 3-4 miles from Heathrow? There's a bus that goes straight there, on the road we turned in from, or it's a very short taxi ride." "Her passport wasn't in 57 Willow Way," Rajavi added. "We turned the place upside down, and her mobile's completely dead, so we haven't been able to track her that way either. Can you get some manpower to check local hotels and B&Bs, and I'll get on to my contact at Border Force and ask them to scan through their exit checks data. They've got access to airlines' advanced passenger data too, though I've no idea how long it would take to find what we need." She smiled at Rajavi, who was crammed into a stab vest over her pale grey maternity top. "And speaking of what we need, I could murder an espresso." "How would you feel about coming to the pub with me?" asked Rajavi. Rachel checked her watch. "Bit early, even for the festive season." "Don't worry, we can stick to coffee, or decaf in my case," Rajavi said regretfully, "while we do a little bit of intelligence gathering." The Hand and Flowers was in full Christmas drinks mode, with Slade and Wizard blasting from the jukebox and a chalkboard menu that included several variations on a turkey theme. A fine Lola Jade collection tin perched on the bar, its label faded almost to illegibility. The pub was also very busy, given that it wasn't yet midday. "This is Terry Harper's local," Rachel said, as they corralled a free table in the corner. "You know, Gavin Harper's dad, Lola's grandfather." "It's also the preferred boozer of my pet narc." Rajavi went to the bar and came back with two mugs of passably decent coffee. "And actually, that trashy story Stacy Fisher leaked to the paper has done us a favour on this occasion. After he read that, he reckons he might have some information that's of interest to us. For a price, naturally." "Naturally," Rachel sighed. "Welcome to policing in the age of information technology."
"And because it's Christmas, and he has extra cider and fags to pay for, of course his rate has doubled."
Rajavi's knock arrived 20 minutes later.
Spud was a wizened, hunched man, with the physique of a jockey, crossed front teeth and a nose that ran constantly, causing him to sniff or wipe his nose on the sleeve of his jacket. Rachel could stand this for less than 2 minutes before offering him a tissue from her bag. He stared as though unsure what to do with it. Rajavi ordered him a double brandy, and Spud launched into a long self-serving preamble, punctuated with much sniffing. "Wait, hold on." Rachel had just glimpsed a familiar figure on the other side of the bar. Terry Harper. Of course. He recognized her and looked startled and ill at ease, glancing over in her direction frequently. "I think we're going to have to take our chat elsewhere. We can't risk him hearing any of this." Next door to the pub, there was a restaurant called the Taj of India. Although it had not yet formally opened for lunch service, the manager let them in when Rachel showed her warrant card and brought them complimentary beer and poppadoms.
"I'm not very good with spicy food," Spud whined. "I think I'll just stick with the English menu."
"Probably best," said Rachel briskly, picturing the impact of chili on Spud's sinuses. She ordered a bowl of dal and some steamed rice to placate the restaurant staff, even though she wasn't hungry, and Spud chose chicken and chips and a bowl of fruit salad and ice cream, shoveling the food into his mouth as though it was the first meal he'd seen in days. Perhaps it was. Only after he had consumed most of it did he start to talk, still punctuating his speech with sniffs.
"You know that missing kid from Eastwell and all the news? Lucy, Lulu..."
"Lola Jade Harper," Rajavi prompted.
"Yeah, that's the one."
Spud scraped the remainder of the vanilla ice cream from the bowl, then waved it at the waiter to indicate that he wanted another one.
"So, a mate of mine, bestie, that drinks at the Flower sometimes, he's in this card school, plays a bit of poker late at night in a room over that dry cleaner's on the Whiteley Road. Anyway, one of the geezers he plays with is this Asian guy, right?"
"Right, go on," said Rachel, wishing that she hadn't had to abandon her coffee next door at the pub.
"So they're playing one night, and he told Bestie, after they'd had a fair few whiskies, that he'd rented out a property to the mum of the girl, the missing girl."
"Michelle Harper," said Rajavi, giving up on her poppadom with a wince. She pressed her hands into her diaphragm and blew out hard.
"Heartburn." "Yeah, Michelle. Hard-faced bint, apparently."
Spud gave a long liquid sniff before embarking on his second bowl of ice cream.
"Nothing wrong with that, you're thinking, Detective Leela. Only she wants to pay cash and keep it all very ash-ash. Doesn't want anyone knowing she was in the property. No written agreements and the like. She was willing to pay over the odds for that. Bestie says the place was only worth about $600 a month, and she paid $900, a whole year's worth up front, and a deposit, just for him to keep it on the QT.
"That's around $12,000 in cash," said Rachel, "and we know where she got that from." "Where is this house?" asked Rajavi. "We need an address."
"Don't know the exact address, just that it's over Albert Park way."
Rajavi took a bunch of £20 notes from her handbag, counted out 10, and laid them on the table between the dal and the ice cream, her hand hovering over them. "You know how this works, Spud. I'm going to need at least a name from you."
"The guy who owns it, the landlord, is called Sunny. Sunil Kara."
Chapter 33.
As Rajavi drove them back to the police station, Rachel checked the balance of the Find Lola Jade Just Giving account. Total raised, £64,761. She phoned Lee Knightley.
"Lee, quick as you can, get me an update on the amount in Michelle Harper's Just Giving account."
Rajavi walked slowly into the station, one hand pressing into the small of her back, the other radioing a patrol car to go and find Sunil Kara.
"These interview rooms are earning their keep this week," she quipped, lowering herself awkwardly into her desk chair. "Are you okay to wait around a bit longer, or do you need to get back?"
Rachel shook her head. "And miss out on being there when you find Lola Jade? No chance." As they waited, she checked her email inbox. "Crowdfunding account currently has a zero balance. Remaining £34,761 transferred to M. Harper's account on Friday, then same amount withdrawn in cash, see below. Lee had attached a screen grab of the statement.
Don't know nothing about no rental house.
Sonny Caro was a short, good-looking young man, his black quiff glossy with hair product, and his mannerisms distinctly cocky. Having declined legal advice, he leaned back in his chair, arms folded, crotch pushed forward, as close to Rachel as possible. The heavily pregnant Rajavi was ignored.
We've had information regarding an arrangement you've made with a woman called Michelle Harper, basically her paying to live in a house you own in Albert Park.
Rachel crossed her legs and swiveled her body sideways to delineate a physical barrier between herself and the thrusting groin. This was why she never wore a skirt to work.
Don't own no house in Albert Park.
Rajavi sighed and tapped her pen on the table. Mr. Caro, we can very easily cross-check with the land registry. That will tell us what you own and where. He grinned smugly, tweaking his quiff.
Seriously, though? You think any of my investments are in my own name? Ladies, please, I'm a businessman. Never heard of the concept of a holding company?
Rachel ached to slap him.
Since this wasn't possible, she pulled herself up straight, emphasizing that she was a couple of inches taller than he was.
Given that you know so much, you'll also know that the maximum sentence for perverting the course of justice is life in prison. Life, Mr. Caro, a businessman, like yourself, she made air quotes, is going to struggle to run his empire from behind bars.
His chin jutted forward in the same plane as his crotch. Rajavi hauled herself to her feet.
Perhaps you'd like some time to think about it. I'm sure we can accommodate you in one of our best ensuite cells. But first you'll need to accompany me to the front desk, so our lovely custody sergeant can charge you.
Caro held up his hands. As Rachel suspected, he didn't want any moral issues to get in the way of his ducking and diving.
Okay, okay, ladies, you win. The house is number 16 Osborne Terrace.
In the end, it all boiled down to numbers and symmetry. In Albert Park, the even house numbers ran down the south side of the streets. The odd numbers were north-facing. So, with Jubilee Terrace and Osborne Terrace running back-to-back, number 17, Jubilee, had number 16, Osborne, directly behind it, separated by the Ginnell, their back gates only a few feet apart. You could leave Lisa Urquhart's house via the kitchen door, cross the backyard and enter the yard of 16 Osborne Terrace within a second, without being seen from either street. It meant that the two properties were effectively adjoined. Rachel stood in the Ginnell, admiring the staggering neatness of the plan, while she and Leela Rajavi waited for the tactical support vehicle to arrive. How easy it had been for Michelle to give the impression she was living at her sister's house, when in fact she was in a separate home only feet away. To pass Harry through the back gate so he could go to school with Lisa and Kirsty's children. Not to Lola Jade's school, but a different one, where no one knew her. And Michelle herself could come and go through the front of Lisa's house with no one suspecting she was actually living in a different building altogether. The inside of number 16 was dark and dismal, the sort of tatty leased property where the landlord was happy to take the rent while letting the place go to rot. The walls were covered with Artex wallpaper stained ochre with tobacco smoke. There were signs of recent habitation in the kitchen, tea bags, a wine bottle and crisp packets in the bin, clean dishes on the drainer. Upstairs, in the two bedrooms, the double bed and the single bed were made but had clearly been slept in. At the foot of the single bed was a familiar sight. Katie Bear. And in the larger bedroom, propped behind one of the curtains in a hasty attempt to hide it, was the huge airbrushed portrait. Lola Jade Harper, leaning on a plastic Doric column in all her glory. Leela Rajavi came to stand beside Rachel, and for a few seconds they were silent.
My God! We found her.
The usually calm D.S. Rajavi sounded close to tears.
Only she's gone again.
Rachel touched her arm briefly before pulling on latex gloves and starting to search through the main bedroom. In the wardrobe, there was a large purple suitcase, one of the matching pair Michelle had taken from Willow Way. She searched through the entire house and the storage shed in the paved yard, but the other suitcase was nowhere to be found. She turned her attention back to Michelle's bedroom, rooting through the drawers in the cheap plywood chest. Suddenly she stopped, her heart racing. A pair of dark blue gloves made from a thin thermal fabric. She examined them, then turned them inside out when she felt something lumpy in the fingers. There, in her palm, were three tiny rhinestones. Rachel recognized them instantly. They were from Michelle Harper's sparkly manicure. On the top shelf of the wardrobe was Michelle's missing passport and a box for a new, unregistered mobile phone. The handset inside was gone. But Michelle had failed to realize that the barcode label had a record of the phone's number in tiny print. In the single bedroom, a forensic officer was pulling items out of the wardrobe. Boys' school uniform and sweatshirts and some pastel-coloured girls' clothes in the same size. Look! Rajavi, who had been helping to search the bathroom, came in with a packet of brown hair dye and a pair of hairdressing scissors. There are still a couple of strands of blonde hair trapped in a crack in the bathroom lino. What's the betting? It's Lola's, from when Michelle cut it off and turned her into Harry. Mom, one of the Tyvek-suited men handed something to Rajavi. I think you need to see this. We found it in the waste bin. It was a screwed-up piece of paper, a half-completed school registration form. The school was St. Francis of Assisi Catholic Primary School, Inglewood. And the name of the pupil, Jasmine Gabriel Hutchins, born 13th of September 2009. The space under names of parents was still blank. Of course, said Rachel with a wry smile, the name of a Disney princess and the name of the chief of the angels. What else for Michelle's princess angel? She turned to the forensics officer. Was there anything else with this surname on? Any mother's details? He shook his head. Just this with the kid's name, but there was a laptop hidden under the sofa cushions. Maybe that will give us more. On her way back into London, Rachel took a short detour off the South Circular Road and drove to Mark Brickell's flat. There was no response when she rang his doorbell, even though she could see the faint gleam of a light behind the curtains of his living room. She phoned him instead. What? His tone was terse. I was just passing your flat, and I wondered if you wanted to go for a drink and a chat, or even a meal and a chat. What for? She sighed. I really need a sounding board. Looks like I was right about the teddy and the purple suitcase. And the picture. Prince, are you smoking crack? No, my brain is fried, that's all, and I need to download before the circuits burn out. Well, sorry, boss, but I'm at a five-a-side footy. And right now I don't even know if I still have a career as a copper at all. So if you need a cosy little chat about case evidence, I suggest you phone your gal pal at Surrey Police. He hung up. Despondent, Rachel drove the mile and a half to the western edge of Crystal Palace Park. She bought a cup of tea from a truck serving hot drinks and walked into the maze, her feet making a satisfying crunching sound on the frozen gravel. It was bitterly cold, the dove-grey sky streaked pale pink and heavy with snow. A few dog walkers made the most of the last remaining minutes of daylight, but otherwise the place was deserted. So rare ever to be alone in London, thought Rachel, to have time to think. That was why she liked to run very early in the morning, rather than after work. And how appropriate to find herself in a maze. That was what this case had been. A series of false turns and blind alleys leading nowhere. And at the centre of the maze was Michelle Harper. After many years as a criminal investigator, Rachel understood that offenders didn't sit around congratulating themselves on the genius of their evil plan. Most deviant behaviour was either stress-based or environment-based, and as a result, felons had no problem justifying their decisions to themselves. Increment by increment, Their actions could become more and more extreme, and yet they could still rationalise what they had done. Some, like Michelle, were so personality disordered that they saw themselves as the ones who were being wronged. Their starting place was the normal sort of life challenge that can face any of us, and the end point was behaviour that most human beings would regard as abhorrent. In between, there was a logical pathway that in their minds justified every step they took. Rachel was quite sure that in Michelle Harper's mind, she was victim, not villain. For Michelle, the first step had been giving birth to a child of the wrong sex. She wanted a girl, not a boy. And because she hadn't got what she wanted, because that rendered her hard done by, quietly suffocating her infant son was what she needed to do. It gave her the chance to start afresh. And when she had her little girl, her princess angel, this appalling act was vindicated. She probably told herself that it could have been an ear or chest infection that finished him off as easily as a gently placed hand over the mouth and nose. But then Gavin threatened her with not only divorce, but losing custody of her hard-won prize, her daughter. How alarmed she must have been when she realised that he had a good chance of winning that battle. And it was that alarm that prompted her next step. She calculated how public knowledge of Gavin's desire to take Lola Jade from her could work to her advantage. Because if Lola disappeared, everyone would assume that Gavin was responsible. All she needed was to set the scene, the abduction attempt, the suggestion of sexual abuse. And ultimately, no one would believe that Gavin deserved Lola Jade more than she did. Lola Jade was only required to disappear for a short time, hence the secret room at 57 Willow Way. Michelle just needed to keep her shut away, adequately silenced by whatever pharmaceutical means, until the immediate fuss died down. She had injected her daughter with some kind of sedative, clumsily, which explained the telltale specks of blood on Lola's bed and the carpet of the hidden room. Rachel's guess was that it was during this initial period that the penny dropped for Michelle. If Lola was miraculously found, the custody battle clock would simply be reset. Gavin would be exonerated of taking his daughter, and instead of her husband being scrutinised, the spotlight would be directed onto her, Michelle. Awkward questions would be asked, and would put her role as mother at risk. So Lola Jade had to stay hidden. Another location had to be found, and another identity. Even a mother as warped as Michelle was going to struggle to keep her daughter locked in a room forever. By renting Osborne Terrace and inventing Harry Brown, Michelle could release Lola Jade back into the world and simultaneously take a step back, distance herself. There was nothing to connect her to Harry, until Ben told Carly Weathers the secret, and she threatened to intervene. Having come so far, and created such a successful illusion, Rachel doubted Michelle would struggle to justify using murder to silence Carly. She had suffocated her own son and got away with it, and in patterns of criminal behaviour, a success like that greatly boosted the perpetrator's confidence and daring next time round. But Rachel now saw clearly the one remaining problem for Michelle. She wrapped her hands tightly round her takeout cup to keep them warm as she walked, turning back in to where the maze started, just as the first flake of snow floated silently from the sky. Harry Brown was ultimately no use to Michelle, because Harry was a boy, and Michelle wanted a daughter, a mirror image of herself to mould and control. And she had to be stopped before she could carry out the final step in the process, the incarnation of Jasmine Gabriel. Chapter 34. Do you remember our friend at Bangla Stores? Rachel looked blankly at Leela Rajavi. She had returned to Eastwell at first light, having barely slept, and was exhausted. Rajavi, too, looked tired and uncomfortable, repeatedly shifting in her chair and pressing her fists into the small of her back.
"Sorry, cramp," she explained.
"The place opposite Happy Nails. We used their security camera to pick up Michelle giving Stacy Fisher the cash." Rachel nodded. The owner heard about Carly Weather's death and remembered seeing her on his own camera footage, so he brought it in last night.
She opened a file on her computer, and Rachel stood up to see it better.
Carly's curls were partially obscured by her Peruvian-style knitted hat, but it was definitely her. She went into the salon and stood near the door, gesticulating at Michelle. Michelle stood up and said something back, shaking her head. The date on the footage was the 1st of December, about 36 hours before Carly died.
"We'll get a better idea what was said by interviewing the other salon employees," Rajavi said. "But this gives us a clear possibility that Michelle knew Carly Weathers was truth-teller."
She winced again and rubbed at her back, squirming in her chair. "And we have Carly's DNA found on Michelle's gloves, the ones in 16 Osborne Terrace, plus DNA from Lola Jade was found on the inside of that big purple suitcase."
"She probably used it to transport Lola from the house in Willow Way to their new rental. It must be just about big enough to fit a young child. God knows what she thought was going on, poor kid."
Rajavi shuddered. "The good news is, the CPS are now happy that we have enough to charge Michelle with Carly Weather's murder." She gave a rueful smile.
"The bad news is, we can't find her," Rachel supplied. "She disappeared at exactly the moment that first leaked headline came out, the one we had to deny. I'll bet my mortgage that's what sent her to ground. Until then, I reckon she thought she'd pulled it off."
"They're working on the log from the burner phone that was found at 16 Osborne Terrace, and the laptop data should be back." Rajavi waved a hand at DC Coles, who was holding up some papers triumphantly.
"Right about now."
"The browser history," he said, fetching a second copy for Rachel so that the two women could read in unison.
"I love search engine histories," said Rajavi with satisfaction. "They're like how to commit a crime manuals."
It was all there, interleaved with a myriad innocent domestic inquiries such as how to replace a fridge light and when is my recycling collected. Back in May, Michelle had asked the internet what dose of propofol would sedate a child weighing 55 pounds and how long it would take to wear off. She wanted to know where to buy it online and how to inject it. Much more recently, she wanted to know what sort of implement would disable a Yale lock, how long suffocation by smothering took in a small adult, how to obtain a fake passport.
"Jesus," said Rachel. "I'm looking forward to hearing her explain this lot."
Rajavi turned to the last part of the printout. "Have you seen this? She's been Googling cheap long-haul flights."
"Let me guess. To Australia."
"How did you know?"
"Because I looked up St. Francis Assisi Primary School in Inglewood at 2 a.m. when I was still awake. It's in Sydney."
Rajavi went to give her a high five, then turned away and grimaced. "Are you okay? Not a contraction, I hope."
"Just heartburn and horrendous lower backache. All a normal part of late pregnancy, apparently."
Rachel turned back to the printout. "There's no sign of her booking any e-tickets, though."
"Of course not."
She slapped her forehead. "She can't use a credit card in her own name. That would leave a digital trail. She's got to use cash, the cash she withdrew from the crowdfunding account, and that means using an agent."
Rajavi read down the last page. "She's Googled travel agents near me and then clicked on one in West Croydon called Magic Tours."
"Very apt." Rachel stood up and pulled on her coat. "Time for our own magical mystery tour." Magic Tours was at the down-at-heel end of the London Road. It had a scruffy shop front and was just big enough to fit one desk and three chairs. This morning it was manned by a heavy woman with dyed auburn hair and a name badge that read Magda Sokolova. She was still in the process of opening up the shop and reluctantly admitted Rachel and D.S. Rajavi, sighing at the inconvenience even after they had showed their warrant cards.
"We need to know if you've completed a booking in the name of Hutchins."
Rachel showed her a photo of Michelle Harper. For this woman. Magda shrugged, her expression dour.
Yes, I have, she said matter-of-factly.
Rajavi pressing her hands against her backside. We need the details, obviously. In no hurry to cooperate, Magda settled herself at her desk with exaggerated care and booted up her ancient-looking terminal.
Is slow,
she commented unnecessarily. Eventually, her connection fired up, and after much tutting and frowning over the printer, which jammed repeatedly, she handed them the reservation details. There were not two, but three tickets to Sydney via Dubai, one for Lauren Hutchins, one for Jasmine Hutchins, and one for Lisa Urquhart.
Of course, Rachel observed. She can't risk travelling with Lola Jade herself. Far too risky. And Lola can't travel as Harry because her official identity in Australia needs to be that of a girl. Harry Brown's over and done with now.
Did she pay cash for these seats? Rajavi asked.
Magda nodded. Cash, yes.
She said this as though it was not unusual to bring nearly £7,000 worth of notes into the shop. Rachel was reading the dates on the ticket, which had been printed in a tiny font.
Michelle's flight's tonight, and Lisa and Lola Jade tomorrow. Okay, we need to get a car over to Jubilee Terrace right now.
Rajavi picked up the airwave set and called for a patrol car to go straight to Jubilee Terrace and arrest Lisa Urquhart for assisting an offender. While she was speaking, Rachel was rereading the details.
She shot to her feet. Shit!
She clapped her hand to her forehead, waving the printout.
It's the connection from Dubai that leaves tonight. The flight to Dubai leaves in...
She squinted at her watch.
80 minutes!
They raced outside to the car, but Rajavi doubled up, wincing again and handing the keys to Rachel.
You drive, this heartburn is killing me!
The airwave set crackled into life. Attempt to locate negative at 17 Jubilee, said the muffled, dismembered voice.
Go for a warrant and set up an AMPR,
Rajavi gasped, pressing her palm down hard on her upper thigh. Rachel filtered onto the M25, switching on the light bar on the car's roof and activating the siren. She glanced over at Rajavi, who was sitting in a strange position.
You okay, Leela?
She responded with a strangled grunt.
Listen, even with the blues and twos on, it's going to take at least 45 minutes to get to Heathrow. I think we should call ahead and get Michelle held at the gate, in case we're not there in time.
Rajavi inhaled sharply and held her breath for a few seconds, letting it out in a rush as the pain passed.
I don't think I can get one of our patrols to arrive there any quicker than we will.
Try the Met's Heathrow station. They'll have someone on the ground at Terminal 3. Rachel glanced in the rearview mirror and floored the accelerator up to 95 miles an hour, trying to remember when she had last used her pursuit driving skills. She usually let Brickle do the macho car chase stuff. It made him happy. Rajavi threw her mobile down in disgust, still clutching at her abdomen.
I've got no signal. You'll have to radio control and get them to phone it in.
As they approached Heathrow, the M25 grew thick with people travelling for the Christmas holidays, and Rachel was having to use the lights to clear a path through the traffic, weaving from lane to lane and struggling to keep up her speed.
Oh, oh God!
Rajavi had pulled her airwave set from the shoulder of her vest, but clutched it aloft as she stared down at her lap. A huge wet pool spread across the crotch of her trousers and over the seat upholstery, trickling down into the seat well. Rachel glanced sharply across at her.
Please don't tell me.
Rajavi nodded.
My waters have gone.
When are you due?
Not for 3 weeks. I've been feeling crampy on and off for the past 24 hours, but I assumed it was just Braxton Hicks.
She looked at Rachel.
Those are practice contractions.
I know what they are, said Rachel tersely. She had to keep her eyes on the road, but was aware of Rajavi tensing up and catching her breath.
This is no practice. Is that a contraction now? I think so.
Rachel stretched across her and took the airwave set, pressing the button and holding it against her left ear as she steered with her right.
Control, this is 1819 Prince. I need a location ID for nearest maternity hospital.
She consulted the GPS in the Byfleet area and a unit to Heathrow Terminal 3 to intercept Michelle Harper, checking in for flight EK209.
It's okay, panted Rajavi. We don't need to stop now. We'll be at Heathrow in half an hour or so, and they have medical facilities. Anyway, nothing's going to happen for hours yet.
Are you sure?
Rajavi spoke through gritted teeth.
Sure, I'll be fine. Just keep going.
Sorry, cancel that.
Rachel switched off the radio set and returned her hand to the steering wheel, but she still glanced at Rajavi every few seconds. Her fists were pressed against her upper thighs, and sweat was breaking out on her forehead.
Leela, you sure you're okay to keep going?
The DS managed to nod her head, but she was holding her breath so forcibly she couldn't speak.
Leela, talk to me!
As they approached Junction 14, Rajavi finally let out a long, low moan and began to pant.
I think it's coming, she said,
her dark brown eyes wild with panic.
The head's really low. I can feel it between my legs.
Oh, fuck. Rachel screeched onto the hard shoulder, hit the hazard lights and snatched up the airwave set again, barking at them to dispatch an ambulance. She then half-pulled, half-lifted Rajavi out of the front seat and laid her along the rear passenger seat, removing her boots, underwear and trousers, and arranging her own coat across Rajavi's lower abdomen in a makeshift attempt at modesty. She had undertaken 5 days of intense medical training in order to become an authorized firearms officer, but, unsurprisingly, it did not cover delivering babies. That scenario had been touched on during her training at Hendon, but she remembered precious little about it.
It's fine,
she said to Rajavi, even though it very much wasn't. I've got this. She retrieved the medical kit from the boot of the vehicle and pulled out a sterile pad, which she placed under Rajavi's hips, and a foil heat blanket to wrap the baby.
Don't try and fight it. Just go with it. If your body's telling you to push, then you have to push.
Rajavi bellowed in fear and pain, and a few seconds later, Rachel was astonished to see a glistening purple-black dome appearing between her legs, topped with dark, wet hair. She took surgical gloves from the medical box and pulled them on, reaching in quickly to guide the head's crowning. Rajavi lowed like a wounded farm animal.
"Don't push too hard,"
Rachel said, hoping this was right.
"Nice and gently does it."
There was a pop and a gush, and the baby slid out into her hands, little fists clenched, curled body seeming strangely small compared to the head. As she cleaned it off with another of the pads, rubbing briskly at the chest, the baby gave a gargling cry, quickly drowned out by the howl of an ambulance siren. A green-suited paramedic rushed over and took the foil-wrapped baby from Rachel's hands. It looked for all the world like a plump oven-ready chicken. It was only when she relinquished her hold that Rachel realized quite how hard her hands had been shaking. She took some deep breaths to dissipate the build-up of adrenaline.
"Is it all right?"
whispered Rajavi, trying to sit up.
"He is perfect,"
Rachel squeezed her hand.
"Congratulations, you have a son."
Chapter 35.
I'm sorry, the flight had already gone by the time the request came through.
And Lauren Hutchins was definitely on it?
Rachel was met at the entrance to Terminal 3 by the on-site liaison for the Metropolitan Police and an Emirates flight dispatcher.
She was, the dispatcher nodded, and 2 items of luggage.
Rachel had been expecting this to happen, given that she had waved off the ambulance, bearing Leela Rajavi and her new son, at more or less the same time the gate was due to close.
"The positive is we currently know exactly where she is," added the police officer,
who introduced himself as PC Ryan Mead. He pointed out of the viewing window at the sky above the runway to make his point.
"And when that flight lands, she's not going anywhere. Will you have her picked up in Dubai?"
Rachel shook her head. "Dubai isn't a member of Interpol, so we have no jurisdiction. It's going to have to be Australia.
So this development is completely embargoed for now, okay? Whatever you do, don't let the press get hold of this. It's because of a recent press leak that she's decided to do a bunk now."
They both nodded solemnly.
"The last thing we want is Harper getting wind of us having a blue card out for her and not reboarding in Dubai.
If it's Australia, that gives me a bit more time to organise the warrant.
I'll speak to my contact at the National Central Bureau in Sydney in a minute, but first..."
Rachel turned to the airline representative.
"Can I see your security cam footage from the check-in desk?"
She was taken to the airline's control centre and shown the images that were captured as standard procedure when passengers checked their baggage. Michelle was wearing over-the-knee boots and skin-tight jeans and had her face partially concealed by the Ant sunglasses. She kept the interaction to a minimum, taking frequent furtive glances around at security staff and her fellow passengers.
Rachel stopped the recording on the frame when the cases were handed over to be weighed. They were two large Louis Vuitton knockoffs. No big purple polycarbonate case. The one in Osborne Terrace, now in the Surrey Police Forensic Lab, was proven to have contained the person of Lola Jade at some point. So where was the second purple case? PC Mead was looking at the arrest paperwork that had been sent through. Michelle Harper. Hold on, isn't she the one whose little girl went missing? Lola Jade?
Yep, Rachel nodded, as she searched through her phone for the number of her contact in Sydney.
The very same. So, if the mother's on her way to Australia, where's the kid?
Due to follow on with her aunt, said Rachel, who must know where Lola is right now.
With nothing more she could usefully do at the airport, Rachel drove back to Eastwell. She felt she ought to return their squad car and break the news that their colleague had successfully, if unexpectedly, become a mother. As she approached Eastwell from the northwest, the car radio set crackled into life. Suspect Lisa Urquhart Mobile, heading northwest on the A420, over. Her trained ear picked up the faint sound of a police siren, probably a few hundred yards away. A car sped past her on the opposite carriageway, exceeding the speed limit. She caught a flash of cyclamen hair through the front window and recognised the beaten-up blue VW Passat belonging to Kevin Urquhart. Kevin was at the wheel with pink-haired Lisa beside him. A police squad car followed, lights flashing. Christ on a sodding bike! Rachel executed a brisk U-turn and followed at a safe distance, swishing on her own lights and siren. The blue Passat picked up speed as the police squad car closed the gap, causing it to veer erratically across the lane to the right. The steering was corrected, overcorrected, and the back wheels hit a patch of melting slush at speed, sending the car spinning, sliding, and eventually flipping over into the ditch, plumes of steam puncturing the December air. The squad car swerved and braked, narrowly avoiding hitting the same slippery patch. Jesus! Rachel pumped her brakes and skidded to a halt as safely as she could, hitting her hazard lights and jumping out of the car. She pulled fluorescent bollards from the boot and dropped them across the road behind her, forcing all the traffic in her wake to slow down and form a queue. The officers in the pursuit vehicle were already out of the car, one shouting into a handset and the other scrambling down the bank towards the crashed Passat. Rachel ran in the same direction, her boots sliding on the frosty tarmac. Kevin Urquhart was moving slightly, blood trickling down the side of his neck. Lisa Urquhart was motionless, thrown forward so far that her head made a pink patch on the windscreen. "Is she alive?" Rachel asked, reaching her warrant card from her back pocket and holding it up. The officer shook his head slowly. "Hard to tell. Touch and go, I reckon. No one in the back of the car?" The officer scrambled further down the bank and cupped his hands against the glass. When he stood up again, he shook his head. "No, small mercy, eh?" "Check the boot," Rachel urged. There was a short struggle, followed by swearing, and eventually the boot lid was prized open. The officer staggered backwards under the weight of a suitcase. Rachel reached over and took it from him, pulling it up the side of the bank and laying it down on the gravelly edge of the lay-by. She unzipped it to reveal a tangled mess of patterned neon beachwear, flip-flops, large grey bras and sun cream. "Looks like they were off on holiday. Why, what were you expecting?" "I thought there might be..." "Never mind. Was that it?" "Empty apart from the case." Rachel gave him a weak smile. "Thanks for checking." More sirens wailed in the distance, and for the second time that day, Rachel watched as an ambulance pulled up, followed this time by a fire engine. The fire crew set about cutting the Passat apart and removing the passengers. Kevin was lifted out first wearing a neck brace, badly injured but conscious. It took longer to remove Lisa. She lay on the backboard, her hair fanned out like the petals of a chrysanthemum, lurid against the greyish white of her face. While the paramedics worked at stabilising her, the police finished photographing the wreck of the blue Passat, and the fire crew set about winching the car from the ditch and loading it onto the recovery truck that had just arrived. Rachel hovered near Lisa as the crew established cardiac output, then lost it, employing the defibrillator to get it back again. Eventually, one of the paramedics shouted, "Okay, she's back. I've got a pulse." With an oxygen mask over her face and a fluid drip attached, Lisa was loaded into the back of the ambulance and it sped away. Rachel watched it go, a heavy sinking sensation in the pit of her stomach. "I could put a nip of something stronger in there. You look like you need it." D.S. Rajavi's colleague D.C. Matt Coles brought Rachel a mug of scalding tea with two sugars in it and waggled a silver hip flask in her direction.
Scotland's finest.
Rachel shook her head. Not while I'm on duty, thanks. But you're right, I could do with it. It's been one hell of a day. She swigged her tea. So far. It's not over yet.
She had broken the news of Rajavi's baby, met with whoops of jubilation, and the Urquhart's crash, met with anger and consternation, when she eventually got back to Eastwell Police Station. She had no idea what time it was, only that it was almost dark.
D.C. Coles sat down opposite her.
I hate to drop even more on you, but there are a couple of new developments.
It's fine. Rachel sipped her tea, fantasizing that it had whiskey in it. Go on.
Our inquiries from the area where we found Michelle's car have thrown up a lead. The manager of a small hotel about half a mile away phoned and reported booking out a room to someone matching Michelle Harper's description. I went to speak to him this morning, and I've got his MG11 if you want to take a look.
He handed Rachel a copy of a witness statement form.
I work at the Crossgates Manor Hotel Feltham as assistant manager. On 19th of December 2016, I was at the reception desk when a woman came in with a little boy. She had three cases with her. She was pulling two and the little boy had the other. I'd say the child was about 7 or 8 years old, quite stocky, with short brown hair. The child didn't speak, and I thought he seemed unhappy. The woman reserved a room in the name of Lauren Hutchins. She showed me a UK passport in that name. She said she wasn't sure when she was leaving and asked if it was okay to pay for the first two nights up front. I agreed, and she paid for the room in cash. At 6:30 a.m. this morning, 20th of December, as I was unlocking the reception desk, she came downstairs with a large purple suitcase. I asked if she wanted a taxi, but she said that she had already ordered one and would wait for it outside on the street. She said she was coming back shortly and would settle the bill then. The child wasn't with her, but I didn't give it too much thought as she was coming back. At 8 a.m. she returned, and around an hour later came downstairs to settle the bill with two more cases. I asked where her son was, and she said he was playing outside. There is a small garden at the rear of the property. She paid the outstanding amount on the bill, in cash, and didn't want a receipt, but asked me to call her a taxi for the airport. The taxi arrived 10 minutes later and she went outside with the luggage. When the chambermaid went to clean the room at 11:30 a.m, it was empty. This statement is true to the best of my knowledge and belief, and I make it knowing that, if it is tendered in evidence, I shall be liable to prosecution if I have willfully stated anything in it which I know to be false or do not believe to be true. Signed by Piotr Zelinski, witnessed by DC4371 Coles. I work at the Crossgates Manor Hotel as a part-time waitress. On the evening of 19th of December, I was on duty in the restaurant. A woman came downstairs with a child and sat at a table for two. I don't remember the exact time, but the restaurant was about to close, so it must have been around 10:30 p.m. I thought it was a bit late for a small child to be eating. The child was wearing pajamas with unicorns on. They looked like girls' pajamas, but the child's hair was cut like a boy's. He didn't speak, and from his eyes I thought he looked as though he was sedated. She ordered a pizza for the child, but he barely ate any, and his head kept dropping onto the plate, like in those YouTube videos of toddlers falling asleep in their dinner. I made a comment about it being past the child's bedtime, and the woman told me it was none of my business. She paid with cash but didn't leave a tip. The second statement was signed by a Jessica Kingdom. Rachel handed them back to Coles. Well, we know where Michelle Harper is now at least. But we need to know what she did with the purple suitcase.
He stared.
Are you saying that Lola Jade, the boy with the short brown hair, was in it? Yes, that's exactly what I'm saying. Okay, well maybe this will help.
Coles handed her another document, which Rachel recognized as a telecoms intelligence unit log.
The phone that was found in Osborne Terrace has just been analysed by our TIU. The texts are all to one number which we've identified as belonging to Lisa Urquhart. That's the one called Phone B. Phone A is Harper's burner.
Rachel skim-read through them, The first two texts were from 3 days earlier on 17th of December. Phone A. Can't drop LJ with you. Too risky. Pigs watching your place. Phone B. Where will you take her then? There's 24 hours before she and me fly. Phone A. We'll find somewhere to leave her safe. Is only for a little while. We'll make sure you have full deets. Don't worry. Kiss. The next day, Sunday the 18th, there was a call from phone A to phone B lasting 12 minutes. At 8:20 a.m. that morning, there was a final sequence of texts. Phone A. Okay, she is there safely in place we discussed, but please, not for long, okay? Gave big dose of stuff to last till you can fetch her, but make sure you're not late because of suffocation risk. And don't tell Kev. Phone B. Don't worry, he thinks I'll just be picking up some of your excess luggage to take with me. Still thinks it's a girl's trip. Kiss. Phone A. Okay, well be careful, Lise. Please, tickets and Elle's passport are in zipped pocket of case. Phone B. Not long now. Can't wait, babes. Kiss. Phone A. Whatever happens, make sure you don't screw up collecting Elle. Can't tell you how urgent this is. Nothing must go wrong. Phone B. Don't stress. Have memorized address of place like you said and will leave plenty of time to get there. Kiss. Phone A. Nearly there now. Fucking Gavin. He's going to have no idea. Rachel tossed the printout onto the desk and grabbed her bag and keys, trying to remember where she had left her car that morning. Code Red Constable, she snapped when Coles didn't immediately jump to his feet. There's only one person who knows where the case is. Lisa Urquhart. Two people if you count Michelle Harper, Coles pointed out. Why don't we try asking her first? He was pulling on a jacket and hat as he spoke. She's going to have to talk to us when she finds out her daughter's at risk. Rachel consulted her watch. Michelle will be arriving in Dubai around now, but like I said before, we don't have any jurisdiction there to intercept her. No, I mean we can call the plane when she takes off for Sydney. She stared at him. Christ, of course. Why didn't I think of that sooner? Coles had already started running out to the car park, climbing straight into a patrol car. So how does it work? Rachel asked as she jumped into the passenger seat and they headed, lights flashing, to Heathrow Terminal 3. Any ground station, like an airline dispatcher or a control tower, can establish two-way communications using VHF frequencies. Well, sometimes they can. It depends on the range. How do you know all that, Einstein? My dad used to be a pilot. They left the car in an emergency bay and ran to the Emirates control centre, only to have an apologetic ground crew supervisor explain that because Michelle had just boarded her connection from Dubai, her flight was automatically out of range of the UK ground antenna. But you can try Medair, she suggested. They have special satellite phones to communicate with all aircraft about medical emergencies. Their operators are based in Farnborough, but they have a rep here, I believe. I'll go, offered Coles, taking in Rachel's washed-out face. Why don't you go and track down some coffee? He returned 15 minutes later, shaking his head. They haven't been able to make contact with the flight, something about weather conditions, but they're going to keep on trying. Should we wait here? Rachel shook her head firmly, handing him a paper cup of coffee. We can't afford to sit around and wait. This is too time-critical. We'll have to try the only other person who knows where that suitcase is. Chapter 36. The accident and emergency department of Ashdead Hospital was filling up with drunk and disorderly Christmas partygoers, along with a smattering of fractures and sprains from falls on icy pavements. Rachel and E.C. Coles had to fight their way through to the reception desk. "We can't give out information about patients," a weary-looking black woman told her. She didn't seem to have noticed that Rachel was flanked by a man wearing a police-issue stab vest, or perhaps she assumed he was fresh from a party and wearing fancy dress. Bristling with impatience, Rachel whipped out her warrant card. The woman glanced at her screen. "Mr. and Mrs. Urquhart have both been taken to the trauma unit. It's back there at the end of the corridor." They found a harassed nurse in scrubs who told them they would have to wait until someone could speak to them. "This is a critical situation. I'm sorry, but it can't wait." Rachel pushed past the nurse into the triage area and started looking in the curtained cubicles, trailing a shell-shocked Coles in her wake. "Excuse me, you can't do that." The nurse trotted after them, pulling the curtains closed again. "I'll get you a doctor." She came back a few seconds later with a doctor also in scrubs, who she introduced as the trauma registrar. "We need to speak to Mr. and Mrs. Urquhart urgently." Rachel forced herself to slow her breathing. She was gabbling now. "We've reason to believe that they know where Loda Jade Harper is." "Lisa Urquhart is in surgery right now." "Where?"
Downstairs in theatre, but I can take you back to speak to Kevin Urquhart. He's quite badly hurt, but he's awake.
He led them into the resuscitation area, which had four bed bays with their curtains pushed back. Kevin Urquhart was just about recognisable through the drips and bandages. His face was cut and bruised and his left leg was in plaster.
Kevin, I'm D.I. Rachel Prince. I'm investigating the disappearance of your niece. I need to speak to you about today's accident.
He couldn't move his head, but his eyes flicked in Rachel's direction.
It was Lisa. She told me to speed up.